Hello, everyone, and welcome back to The Talking Show.
Hello, everyone. Radio,
broadcasting live from Chinatown in sunny Los Angeles, California.
That's right.
It's great to be back. Steve and I are coming off a long, much-needed vacation.
Yeah, no
that
kidding.
That was graciously funded by our labor union. Steve, why don't you tell the good people a little bit about what we did?
Well, mostly we just stuck to the beach, but for a little while we went out and took a tour of some vineyards in the wine regions. Yeah, we sampled a many good wines. It was really sensational, Nick. And the part I think I liked the most was we stayed at this little B&B in just, you know, north of Solvang. And it was called Auberge de some, anyway, I forget. But boy, breakfast was just to die for there. It was really something else. There's nothing on earth quite like a really good breakfast.
Right. It was excellent. Very good. And your tan is impeccable.
Oh, well, you're too kind.
So today's guest is a very special lady by the name of Marjorie Perloff. Steve, why don't you share some insights on Marjorie Perloff's work with our listeners?
Oh, well, I'd love to, but I don't really know anything about her, unfortunately.
Okay, well, I will do it then.
Please be my guest.
Perloff is an impressive scholar and writer who mostly focuses on poetry, and sometime writes a little bit about sound. She seems to spend most of her time in sunny California, so we can all empathize with her there. And I have in front of me one of my favorite books by Marjorie Perloff, and it's a recent book called Unoriginal Genius. And I thought I'd share a little segment of that with everyone. Just give me a second, it's right here in front of me. This is from page 99 for those of you following along. Halfway through Susan Howe's complex book-length poem, The Midnight, a poetic text that embeds varieties of prose as well as treated photographs, reproduced paintings, maps, catalogs, facsimiles of tissue interleaves, and enigmatic captions, is what is a tripartite sequence of short, highly formal. Wow, that is great. What do you think about that, Steve?
Well, geez, with my appetite so thoroughly whetted, I'm practically itching to hear today's guest speak. Let's just move on with that, don't you think?
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. Okay, everyone, well, we're going to get right to it. Please sit back and relax and enjoy Marjorie Perloff.
The familiar myths about the avant-garde die hard. Almost a century after the creation of Duchamp's early ready-mades, I'm just going to flash the match a little bit, the bicycle wheel, there's the bottle rack of 1915, the snow shovel called in advance of the broken arm, and the upside-down urinal, famously called fountain, here and then in the Stieglitz version. The common wisdom continues to be that the ready-mades, what Duchamp called la sculpture toute faite, are ordinary manufactured objects that the artist selected, labeled, and signed, pronouncing them art by simple fiat. Duchamp's ready-mades, Alan Capra, remarked in 1973, quote, are radically useful contributions to the current scene. If simply calling a snow shovel a work of art makes it that, the same goes for all of New York City, or the Vietnam War, or a pedantic article on Marcel Duchamp. Conversely, since any non-art can be art after the appropriate ceremonial announcement, any art theoretically can be de-arted, and he refers to Duchamp's Rembrandt, whose Rembrandt is an ironing board. Now, we can trace assessments like Capra's back to much earlier evaluations, beginning probably with Peter Berger's still influential, though more skeptical pronouncement in Theory of the Avant-Garde, and by the way, at the beginning of this new literary history issue, there he is again defending this view and saying this one is the correct view. And here's Peter Berger. When Duchamp signs mass-produced objects, a urinal, a bottle dryer, and sends them to art exhibits, he negates the category of individual production. The signature, whose very purpose it is to mark what is individual in the work, is inscribed in an arbitrarily chosen mass product, because all claims to individual creativity are to be mocked. Duchamp's provocation not only unmasks the art market, where the signature means more than the quality of the work, it radically questions the very principle of art in bourgeois society, according to which the individual is considered the creator of the work of art. Duchamp's ready-mades are not works of art, but manifestations. Now, those words were written some 35 years ago, but there's no indication that Berger has ever changed his mind. In a recent catalog essay for a Jeff Wall exhibition in Vienna, for example, Berger repeats his conviction that Duchamp's ready-mades have nothing to do with individual artistic genius. They're famous simply because Duchamp was the first to make the claim that any ordinary object can be a work of art, if you say it is. The corollary, of course, is that there can be no meaningful distinction between high and low art. In his influential After the Great Divide of 1986, Andreas Huysen echoes Berger in asserting that Duchamp's urinal can be classified as art, quote, only by virtue of the fact that an artist exhibited it. And Huysen puts it this way. In those days, he's talking about the war years, World War II, the audience recognized the provocation and was shocked. It understood all too well that Dada attacked all the holy cows of bourgeois art religion. And yet Dada's frontal attack was unsuccessful, not only because the movement exhausted itself in negation, but also because even then, bourgeois culture was able to co-opt any attack made on it. Duchamp himself saw the dilemma and withdrew from the art scene in 1923. Now, that statement is oddly confused. It's always amazing what things get published and get famous and so on. Dada may well have attacked all the holy cows of bourgeois and art religion, and even that's a sweeping generalization, but Duchamp is not synonymous with Dada. The fact is that Duchamp hadn't so much as heard of Dada when on a notepad of 1913 he posed the urgent question, can one make works that are not works of art? Can one make works that are not works of art? Or when in 1915 he produced the mechanical drawing of the chocolate grinder, the wood box with canvas measure strips on glass called the three standard stoppages, and the first ready-mades, the bottle rack and the bicycle wheel. These last two left behind in his Paris studio when he came to the U.S. and accidentally thrown in the trash by his sister, Suzanne. Duchamp wrote to her and he said, can you, you know, I would like to have those things. They're in my studio. They're just little things. And she said, oh, she was sorry. She thought that was trash and she had thrown them out. The first enigmatic notes and drawings for the large glass were made in 1915. By 1916, when his friend François Picabia introduced Duchamp to Tristan Tzara's La Première Aventure Céleste de Monsieur Antipyrine, aspirin, Duchamp had completed in advance of the broken arm, the snow shovel suspended by its handle, which I'm going to come back to, in a glass case with hidden noise, the ball of string between brass plates with a secret noisemaker inside, possibly, I've talked about that work before, and fountain. It wasn't at all after seeing Dada things that these words were made, Duchamp assures Pierre Camus. Indeed, in 1920, he refused to participate in the Paris Dada Salon, responding to his friend Jean Coty's invitation with the two-word telegram, peau de balle. Peau de balle, like balls to you. As for withdrawing from the art scene in 1923, as Huysen claims, Duchamp was on the contrary beginning a new phase of his career, which included the various boxes and the boîte en valise, the roto reliefs, and especially the ultimate ready-made étant donné, right here in Philadelphia. The latter, after all, did not go on view at the Philadelphia Museum of Art until 1967, the year before Duchamp's death. Now, were the ready-mades, as Huysen implies, a response to World War I? Indirectly, yes, in that it was the war that prompted Duchamp's decision to leave Paris and its increasingly oppressive milieu artistique for New York, where he came into contact with a whole new world of advanced technology. Were the indifferent objects Duchamp found or bought designed in Bergerian terms as an assault on bourgeois high culture and rapidly co-opted by the capitalist art market? Was Duchamp's manifestation an assault on the institutionalization of art that's a very fashionable view today in the modernist museum, or was something else at stake? Duchamp scholars, Calvin Tompkins, William Canfield, and especially Thierry Deduve, have written brilliantly about Fountain itself, its purchase, submission to the first exhibition of the Society of Independent Artists in April 1917, its vociferous rejection followed by witty rehabilitation, the Stieglitz's artful photograph, and its particular visual and semantic meanings. But little attention has been paid, and that's what I'm going to talk about tonight, to the relation of Duchamp's urinal to the artworks, mostly paintings, submitted and shown by the Independents, works that reflect the popular conception of what art was in the war years in America. 65. It's a relationship important not only in clarifying Duchamp's own aesthetic, but in helping us attain a more accurate picture of the way individual genius positions itself vis-a-vis the dominant art practices and even the experiments of its own time. So this first section is called The Deferral of Painting. The directors of the first exhibition of the Society of Independent Artists, held at the Grand Central Palace on Lexington Avenue in the spring of 1917, consisted of three groups: William Glackens, the president, George Bellows, Rockwell Kent, and Maurice Prendergast represented the Ashcat School, which dealt primarily with realistic subject matter, although Bellows' entry for the Independents, Cattle and Meadow Hills, 1916, used bright expressionist color to create mood. Alfred Stieglitz's 291 group was represented by John Marin. Stieglitz was not on the board, but he and Paul Strand did contribute some earlier photographs, namely the wonderful and famous to the exhibition. The third group was drawn from the Arensberg Circle. Arensberg himself was the managing director and included Duchamp, Man Ray, Joseph Stella, John Covert, and Morton Schamburg. Duchamp was also chosen to be the chairman of the three-man hanging committee. I love that. The others were Bellows and Kent, right? An irony here. Here are the committee. See the committee? There's Marcel Duchamp, the chairman of the hanging committee, with Bellows and Kent. So he's very active in all this. Yeah. And that was an irony, since he himself was no longer making paintings. It was Duchamp who came up with the notion that the sequence of the exhibits to be hung in alphabetical order, as had the paintings in the earlier 1910 exhibition of independent artists, should be determined by drawing a letter from a hat. The arbitrariness of this procedure, the letter turned out to be R, so the first room of paintings were all R paintings that began, the artist's name began with R, caused consternation among society members. The powerful artist Robert Henri, here's a typical painting by Henri, Robert Henri, withdrew from this society, and the noted patron and collector John Quinn, who many of you know from the Yates Connection and Pound Connection, called it democracy run riot. The rationality of the no jury, no prizes policy governing the exhibition, the foreword to the catalog explains, was based on the policy of the Société des Artistes Indépendants in Paris, founded in 1884. The Indépendants had cited the authority of none other than the most prominent of classical painters, Ingres, who had declared, "A jury, whatever the means adopted for its formation, will always work badly. The need of our time is for unlimited admission to the salon. I consider unjust and immoral any restriction tending to prevent a man from living from the product of his work." The great impressionist painter Renoir was also cited as an opponent of the prize system. No prizes, no juries. Therefore, everybody could be an artist. According to Article 2, Section 3 of the bylaws of the Society of Independents, any artist, whether a citizen of the United States or of any foreign country, may become a member of the society upon filing an application, therefore paying the initiation fee and the annual dues of a member, and exhibiting at the exhibition in the year that he joins. The initiation fee was $1, the annual dues $5, so today that would be more like probably 50 or even more. But anyway, for $6, any self-designated artist could therefore exhibit up to 2 works. For another $4, each artist could buy the space for 1 illustration in the catalog. Now, the response to this call for submissions was astonishing. The exhibition included 2,125 works by 1,235 artists, 821 men, 414 women. More women than had been in the earlier show, but still a lot less. Arranged in alphabetical order, regardless of manner or medium, although in practice the medium was predominantly oil painting, along with a few sculptures, drawings, and photographs. Among the 1,235 artists were some famous names, from Picasso and Picabia to John Metzinger, Marston Hartley, John Sloan, Arthur Dove, Charles DeMuth. Most of these, though, presented by earlier and lesser work, and hence not especially noted by the exhibition's reviewers. The vast majority, in any case, were entirely unknown. On the two-column list of P's in the catalog, Picabia is next to Love Porter, Picasso next to Alexander Portnoy. I always wonder whether that has anything to do with Portnoy's complaint, but I don't think so. But that was the name, anyway, of that artist. The democratic policy governing the exhibition elicited strong response. 20,000 people were reported to have filed through the galleries of the Grand Central Palace on Lexington Avenue during its month-long run from April 10th to May 6th. 20,000 people, a lot of people going to an exhibition at that time. Duchamp, whose New York reputation was still based primarily on his new Descending a Staircase, exhibited at the Armory Show of 1913, made no submission to the Independents. But 2 days before the official opening on April 10th, an object titled Fountain was delivered to the Grand Central Palace, together with an envelope bearing the membership and entry fee of one Richard Mutt of Philadelphia. Duchamp and the company of Arensberg and Joseph Stella had purchased this object a few days earlier from the showroom of J.L. Mott Ironworks, a manufacturer of bathroom fixtures at 118 Fifth Avenue. It was a flat-back Bedfordshire model porcelain urinal. Duchamp, Calvin Tompkins tells us, had taken it back to his studio, turned it upside down, and painted on the rim at the lower left in large black letters the name, you see it, R. Mutt, and the date, 1917. So that was the object. The reaction to this entry was electric. Bellows found the urinal obscene and refused to exhibit it. Arensberg praised its lovely form, but to no avail. At the 0 hour before the opening, the 10-member board of directors met and voted by a small margin to turn down Richard Mutt's submission. When Glackens, the president, declared that it was by no definition a work of art, Duchamp and Arensberg immediately resigned from the board in protest. Fountain disappeared from the premises. No one could say what had happened to it. But a week later, it turned up in Stieglitz's 291 gallery, and soon, at Duchamp's request, and bear in mind that it was always Duchamp's request, the great photographer made the urinal immortal by photographing it in front of a painting by Marston Hartley entitled The Warriors, see here it's sketched in, setting its smooth curve against the similar ogival shape in the painting so that it resembled a sculpture in a niche. It was soon dubbed by Duchamp's acquaintance the Madonna or Buddha of the bathroom. And that's a still of it. A photograph found in the Arensberg collection of the fountain cropped makes this point even clearer. So the Madonna, Buddha of the bathroom. But why did Duchamp want Stieglitz to give his urinal this aesthetic dimension? It was a move in keeping with a related one. On the opening night of the exhibition, Duchamp declared that the two best paintings in the show were Louis Alchimiste's Rosemary Calling, also known as Supplication, and Dorothy Rice's The Clare Twins. Here are the Clare Twins. This judgment, cited the next day in the New York Sun by the art critic Henry McBride, was as widely quoted as it was wonderfully absurd. Alchimiste was a painter influenced by the Hudson River School, who was largely scorned by the New York art world for his kitschy eroticism, as well as his extravagant self-promotion. In a series of pamphlets, he claimed to be an unrecognized genius, painter, poet, musician, inventor, mystic, educator, linguist, prophet. As Thierry Dedouve puts it, everybody gossiped about him, nobody took him seriously, no gallery was showing him. Indeed, the large breast that arm-waving, histrionically posed nude in a pastel landscape of supplication, it's also the last picture in the catalog. On the very last page of the catalog before the ads, is this picture, belongs not to the world of charming, delicate, and elegant portraits that dominated the Independence galleries, but rather to the parodic world of the mustached Mona Lisa, of El Achot Occul, or even more uncannily to the sphere of Etienne Tonnet. But the case of the Clare twins is even more intriguing. The painting now lost, this painting is lost. We know it only through the black and white reproduction in the New York Sun for April 15th, 1917. And there's a copy of that which I saw at the Beinecke. I'm so glad the Beinecke has it. You can't see it anywhere else that I know of. And that's a pretty bad newspaper reproduction by this time of this painting, of the Clare twins. This is a kind of poorly painted double portrait of the enormously overweight and grotesque female twins who evidently performed in a sideshow at the Barnum and Bailey Circus. Absurdly decked out in fancy dress with inappropriately girlish headbands and flowers in their hair, the two women, first of all, they don't look like twins, do they, really, have vapid expressions. One holds a doll, I hope you can see that there, the doll she's holding in her awkwardly painted hand. The relation of figure to dark ground is handled with little skill. Indeed, this unpleasant painting bears little resemblance to the countless pretty portraits in the exhibition, which we'll see in a minute, portraits of young girls in flouncy dresses, charming matrons, silhouetted against fireplaces, and so on. In his review of the Independence for the New York Sun, Henry McBride remarks that after seeing one too many soporifically correct pictures of the sort that are usually rejected, even by the Academy, he was delighted to stumble upon that stupendous production by Miss Dorothy Rice, the Clare twins. And he wrote, everybody laughs when they see those twins. Even the Baron de Meyer laughed. Marius Desaires of the Modern Gallery seemed positively glued to the floor in front of them. You'll be having that down in your gallery next, I bantered him. I should be only too proud, he returned. I can't believe a woman did that. It's strong. She asked but 5,000 for it, and that was a big joke. Nothing cost that much in the whole show. 5,000 was a ridiculously large amount. And that was the price tag. There were little cards with price tags next to each picture. She asked but 5,000 for it, said Mr. Montrose, examining the little white card beside the picture. And McBride adds, in regard to the Clare twins, there will be many to agree with Mr. Duchamp instead of the price mark, but no one that I have heard of yet agrees with him in regard to supplication by Alchemius. Now, what was it about the Clare twins that made everyone laugh? To begin with, Duchamp's selection and high price tag are patently absurd given the amateur status of the painting, and I did some research on this, very scanty. The information about Dorothy Rice, her dates are 1892 to 1960. But we know the following. She was the daughter of a wealthy New York financier who had studied briefly with Robert Henri and is listed as having contributed interest, time, and money to the organization. In other words, she was a donor, really. She gave a lot of money for this exhibition, like the Kelly Ryder says, in 1910. Briefly married to the well-known artist Waldo Pierce, a great friend of Hemingway's. She dabbled in art, novel writing, and aviation. I found that very interesting. In 1916, she was one of the first women to receive a pilot's license. Divorcing Pierce in 1917, she married a banker and sportsman named Hal Sims. And those of you on you know, the game, the Sims family, that used to be a big game children played. Video game, Hal Sims. And she took her place in society, and evidently after that, she never entered any painting in any show, or she sort of lost interest in that. She did a lot of other things. She traveled a lot. In singling out the Clare twins, Duchamp may well have been playing one of his elaborate spoofs. Did Dorothy Rice actually paint this now last picture? this picture and submit it. Her name does not appear in the list of addresses at the end of the Independence catalog. And given the absurdly high price tag, it's just possible that Dorothy Rice was no more than a cover for Duchamp himself. The Claire twins, whether strictly speaking Rice's or Duchamp's own creation, providing grist for the mill of Le Marchand du Sel, or Rose C'est la Vie, the various inventions that we have on Duchamp. Like Alchimius' supplication, in any case, Duchamp's chosen painting looks ahead to the grotesque Houri, which we're familiar with from Etant Donnée. But what is especially remarkable is the relationship of the Claire twins to its neighbors in the show. And by the way, one thing I should say is, in the addresses in the back, they list all the artists with their addresses. And there is no Dorothy Rice, but there are a couple of other Rices, men. There's a man named always living on 67th Street, 10 West 67th. Well, Arensberg lived it, I think, 10 West or 12 West. That was the studio. And so there are obviously all kinds of jokes there. But anyway, she's not mentioned, and there's no reproduction of this painting in the catalog. Presumably she didn't pay the $4 to also have a painting in the catalog. Now, what's especially remarkable is the relationship of the Claire twins to its neighbors in the show. Although the exhibition opened 3 days after the U.S. finally declared war in Germany on April 7th, the 2,000-plus paintings almost uniformly opted for the prettiness and charm that had characterized Impressionism. The late watered-down Impressionism of portraits in the vein of Manet, Degas, and Renoir, primarily of ladies, I'll show you some, that are in the catalog, which is typical.
So, you know, we just—it seems like it's been really crazy.
Mostly by artists that are now not known at all. The garden seat,
like
the bunker.
They're always just kind of like spin the ball.
And there's some nudes.
These young girls.
They're little girls. Lots of little girls like this.
Love to stir up sexual energy.
Little girls. There are many in this vein, and then there are a few nudes, like this one. These two nudes, but lovely. The other big genre is landscape painting. Again, in the realist or impressionist style. Here, I'll show you some landscape paintings. June morning, Kinderhook Creek. There are all the bridges and creeks. Lovely landscapes. These were pretty standard and they're an awful lot.
Operation Get Hitched.
The Trout for a winter in Connecticut.
Oh, yeah, man.
Doesn't matter, whatever. I'll put up with anything.
No, I just
the goal is.
No, not really. Some symbolist paintings like this one and expressionist ones. This is an interesting one, Maternity by Marguerite Zorach, and she was known. She was quite well known. So there was that. Oddly, in view of the fact that the Great War is now in its fourth year, there were few paintings on the subject, and even those. Here's Henry Roterdahl's London in Wartime. I couldn't get over this one. It's very pretty in color. Has flags and looks like a celebration of some kind. All right, London in Wartime. Represented the picturesque city rather than anything that might be upsetting. Even Francisco Houses' Victims of War, this one, recalls a Madonna and Child rather than the technology of air bombardment or trench warfare. You really wouldn't know any of these things were happening. All in all, there was little in this blockbuster exhibition that didn't satisfy the aesthetic norms of, say, Robert Maury, whose popular The Art Spirit of 1923, I don't know if you can see that, but I'll read it anyway,
has
recently been
not,
reissued in an 85th anniversary edition. You can get it on Amazon.com, this book, The Art Spirit, and it contains nuggets like the following.
I mean, they did say that.
There are moments in our lives, there are moments in a day when we seem to see beyond the usual. Such are the moments of our greatest happiness. Such are the moments of our greatest wisdom. If one could but recall his vision by some sort of sign, it was in this hope that the arts were invented. Signposts on the way to what may be. Signposts to great knowledge. The effect of brilliancy is to be obtained principally from the oppositions of cool colors to warm colors and the opposition of grave colors with bright colors. If all the colors are bright, there is no brightness. Whatever you feel or think, your exact state at the exact moment of your brush touching the canvas is in some ways registered in that stroke. It is harder to see than it is to express. The whole value of art rests in the artist's ability to see well what is before it. Art cannot be separated from life. It is the expression of the greatest need of which life is capable, and we value art not because of the skilled product, but because of its revelation of life's experience. Paint what you feel, paint what you see. Paint what is real to you. 5 minutes consideration of the model is more important than hours of what has
That's funny.
To paint is to know how to put nothing on canvas and have it look like something when you stand Paint what you feel, paint what you see.
Doing their thing.
Shortly after the opening of the 1917 exhibition, the first issue of a small magazine called The Blind Man came out. Issue one was the independence number. The cover boasted a caricature by Alfred Frew representing a blind man guided through the painting exhibition by his dog. The public, it was implied, not very subtly, is blind to advanced arts. As for the critics, they are deemed to be even worse. In her article for The Blind Man, Mina Loy remarked sarcastically, only artists and serious critics can look at a grayish stickiness on smooth canvas. The second issue, 6th May 1917, which came out immediately after the exhibition had closed, the cover featured Duchamp's chocolate grinder, which I showed you earlier, and above the title, Blind Man, are the letters P and Q, identifying the supposedly anonymous editors as Henri Pierre Boucher,
whether that tube is kinked or then something sitting on that tube or whatever, that would keep it from graining properly,
and Tortoise, the nickname Boucher had given to Duchamp. Inside the issue, there appears an unsigned editorial of Richard Muttcase, side by side, with a reproduction of Falcon here, as photographed by Stieglitz, and almost certainly the editorial was written by Duchamp himself. The Richard Muttcase. They say any artist paying $6 may exhibit. Mr. Richard Mutt sent in a fountain. Without discussion, the article disappeared and never was exhibited. What were the grounds for refusing Mr. Mutt's patent? Something terrible was immoral, vulgar. Others, it was plagiarism, plain piece of plumbing. Now, Mr. Mutt's stuff is not immoral, that is absurd. No more than a bathtub is moral. It is a picture that you see every day in plumbers' show windows. Whether Mr. Mutt with his own hands made the fountain or not has no importance. He shows it. He took an ordinary article of life, placed it so that its useful significance disappeared under the new tone, and pointed it and created a new thought for that object. As for plumbing, that is absurd. The only works of art America has given us are plumbing and
like
that. He chose it, and it shows, moreover, an absolutely ordinary object. It's that declaration, of course, that's a comic cover of to declare that Duchamp was not a negation of a certain form of art, but an assault on the institution of art in bourgeois capitalist society. The avant-garde by this record is distinct from modernism, with its insistence on the autonomy of
art.
For the avant-garde breaks down the great divide
between high and low. I think I'm going to make that a Tupperware.
Now here we have to reconsider what a choice really means.
Let's get systematic, because that's
current. Suppose we try to assess Duchamp's state of mind on the eve of the 19th exhibition of the independence.
Dishes, glasses.
Glasses. I think this
that
is still pretty
exhibition
good.
Here, after all, helped to harden it.
Of the 25 works shown, none was especially risque. Even Brancusi's brilliant entry, an abstract suggesting a phallic Polaroid sketch, ironically called First Princess Bonaparte, and then the Princess, and there are many various versions of Princess, did not ruffle many feathers. Unlike Fountain, after all, Brancusi's Princess, made of polished bronze, sat on a handsome pedestal like a real sculpture. An earlier marble version, dating from 1909, there it is, the way it was shown. But this version had already been shown in Paris in 1909. So nobody was going to be very shocked with that. They had gone
usually
Fountain by R. Mutt, so elegantly photographed by Stieglitz, must then be understood as being in dialogue with the approved artworks of its time. Indeed, the Independence catalog boasts three other fountains. Helen Farnsworth Mears fountain.
Yeah, I mean, there's all these jars sitting around.
Elizabeth Pendleton's drinking fountain.
Yeah, that's true.
So it's like there's jars.
And Frederick Detweiler's Miraculous Fountain.
Get rid of it there, and we'll take that out.
Now, this last image is a painting of
Petzl. This stuff makes sense, kind of, too. It's like canned goods and stuff. But there's
a traditional image of the Fountain of Life.
Or that can go over there.
Okay, well, either way, okay, so I have to be at a meeting at 2, and I want to put
Farnsworth and Pendleton are a little different. The first one displays
just take a
Cupid,
quick look at this stuff and take everything out.
With a horn and arm raised, summoning the animals.
Put everything in a jar, and then I'll clean the shelf.
I guess maybe bunnies, right?
Put it together.
Sound good? Depicting running around a shallow circular bowl of oil placed on a stone slab. Pendleton's recalls Art Nouveau. Her drinking fountain for birds has an elegant column with acanthus leaves and other decor, and it's topped by twin, I think those are pelicans. A stork stands below, presumably waiting its turn to drink from the fountain. Now, the good question is, why are these works, three works, deemed works of art, whereas Duchamp's fountain couldn't even be exhibited? Obviously, because they were handmade objects, objects that displayed craft, a decorative flair that struck to make each fountain a unique piece.
Just not get stuff confused.
Yet the irony is that Duchamp's fountain is Duchamp's fountain that is unique even visually. If you look back at it, traditional upright urinals.
Right.
This one.
Jack Spector reminds us in a witty essay called Duchamp's Gender
were
designed to receive and remove a standing man's urination, his jet d'eau fountain, in contrast to the
stream.
Indeed, it has been
argued
that Duchamp's fountain had an exclusionary
status
for Frenchmen. Its awkwardness for women was sexism, and it's probably true. But Duchamp seems to have anticipated
this
critique. Turning his urinal upside down.
Oh, is this something you're doing?
I've been working on that.
Then they never saw
with his comparable male female.
Why does my family give me these
things?
Was
carefully chosen.
It's adorable. You can't throw it out. It's
so
yours for life.
Question, anything is wrong.
Maybe you should find a place outside of the kitchen for that stuff.
As the colors.
Like a storage cubby
the museum
for
is institution. But
your
family is in subtle dialogue with those artworks at the time.
A vault of memory.
Consider, for example, the case of the painting early in the Henrik Hillbaum's The Making of an American. Now, I found this one on E.I.L. I found it
on E.I.L. They love you. You know your family.
Color on this painting you can buy. Here, to the pictures. Also, $5.
All right, you take it on that. I'll take on
the Making of an American carries a pride. I'll show it to you here because you can see it a little better. And is described as follows by the Fantasia Antiques, which is this wonderful oil on canvas painting is circa 1910 and was painted during the First World War, which is hardly a 1910. That's what you get when you read these eBay things. It shows a standing Liberty figure. There's your Liberty. A man, a woman, baby, child, eagle, and cornucopia, and much more. Note the patriotic influence of Impressionist Charles Poussin, also in the Illuminati's exhibition, one of Hillbaum's compatriots at the Old
Line,
who also painted in the patriotic Impressionist style. I love that. That's a phrase I've never heard. Patriotic Impressionist. That's a style for us all to remember. Work it. The painting measures 30 by 24. The colors are marvelous. It has been brought back to its original vibrancy by Page Conservation Project. Restorers for the National Gallery of Art. It is a real treat. And the website copy goes on to tell us about Henrik Hillbaum, 1863-1948, who was born in Sweden, studied in Paris with Benjamin Constant and Jules Lefebvre. Hillbaum, quote, was a member of the Old Lyme Colony School.
Where do potlets go?
Gaining its name due to the large number of paintings there, living in Old Lyme, Connecticut, which became the first major art colony in America to encourage impressionists. Old Lyme was accessible to New York City-based painters by excellence.
I like that kind of thing, really, but I don't know anything about it, so I'm suspicious of it.
So that's, you know, good reason.
That bamboo is mine.
Now, Duchamp would have relished this delicious description, especially the dating of the World War I painting.
I'm just trying to chill out.
One cannot help wondering if he had seen it by 1915.
Oh, hey, I bet you wondered where this was.
American ready-made, the snow shovel with a flat
where's my lemon juicer?
And a wooden hammer, which he bought in a hardware store.
And then it's
his Calvin Tompkins notes. There were thousands just like in hardware stores all over America, stacked up in advance of the winter stores, or as Duchamp would say in the title that he inscribed on the metal reinforcing plate across the business end, in advance of the why did he choose this particular item? He had never seen a snow shovel before, he explained some years later. They didn't make such things in France. Duchamp, after taking it home and signing it from Marcel Duchamp, 1915, to show that it was not by, but simply from the artist, tied a wire to the handle and hung it from the ceiling. Describing his newest ready-made in a letter to his sister Suzanne, Duchamp remarked, "Don't try too hard to understand it. In the Romantic or Impressionist or Cubist sense, it has nothing to do with it. But of course, it does have a great deal to do with it as complex parody. Now, the picture of the famed Liberty figure, the secular goddess, the American flag, silhouetted against the American flag, proffering a huge shovel to the eager man who is flanked on one side by a young boy, no doubt his son, and on the other by his wife, holding a baby in her shawl, is the quintessential patriotic image of the welcoming of Americans, welcome immigrants to the American soil, where a cornucopia of fruit and vegetables in the lower right greets the new worker to be." And the title immediately brings to mind Gertrude Stein's The Making of Americans, written in Paris between 1906 and 1908. And Duchamp knew Stein very well. In this context, Duchamp's in advance can be construed as...
These all don't have homes. These are all like extras, so presumably
really
garbage.
Like, that. Think it through.
I don't know where this would go.
First piece of art, they hadn't made it in France. It's an American thing. Well, you want a making of an American?
Oh, yeah, that's a good idea.
And the snow shovel rendered useless, providing his own light of work as a new arrival. Romanticism, impressionism, more specifically patriotic impressionism, as it's called on the Fantasia antique side.
I mean, I haven't used the paperwork since I've been here. But this is what we've got up here. There's not a lot of stuff up here now that we've actually looked at it and put it in a pile. Oh shit, those are great.
Bear that in mind. Now, such paintings as May Audubon Post's nostalgic for Spinner must have made Marcel Long to be photographed with his own bus.
Those are fucking great, though.
A spin, can't really move it. Yes, that thing's so, great. For what world were the independence organizers, contributors, and viewers living in? April 1917, Duchamp had long ago rejected one-to-one mimesis for photographic realism that might have given the audience images of trench warfare and angle collapses, knew that at the least art must recognize the technology of the present. Ergo, not Christine Lumsden's Theodora with her long raven tresses, but instead, and we got this soon by 1916, an ordinary steel dog comb. And this is the comb that has the caption, classified combs by the the steel dog home in any way attractive. Like Duchamp's chosen favorites, Alchimius' Supplication and the Rice's The Clare Twins, those grotesque counterparts of the lovely ladies and idyllic landscapes that filled the 1917 exhibition. The ready-mades usher in a new era. The enemy is neither New York capitalist culture, which Duchamp finds quite exhilarating.
What's that?
He's very happy to be in any exhibition or any museum. This notion of hating the museum is not quite right. On the contrary, Duchamp wanted very much to have his work on display. No one was more delighted than he when in 1951 the Philadelphia Museum agreed to purchase the entire Ahrensburg collection, including the bulk of Duchamp's own work, and to allow the artist to plan the precise layout of the individual pieces. In Duchamp's correspondence, you can read exactly how he decided where to place the work. Display was very important to doing it right in Ahrensburg, because out of California, Duchamp was ill. Anyway, once again, it seems Duchamp was to become the chairman of the hanging group. By this, I said to go from curator to creator. The choice of ready-mades, Duchamp famously told Pierre Papin in the late 60s, is always based on visual and
different, but at the same time, on the choice of good.
Now, before we conclude, there's so many critics that Duchamp is here with rejecting art as an autonomous category. Let's read further. Here's a passage in the proceeding. I shy away from the word creation. In the ordinary social meaning of the word, it's very nice, but fundamentally I don't believe in the creative function of the artist. He's a man like any other. It's his job to do certain things, but the businessman does certain
things. How long does the short cycle run for?
On the other hand, the word art interests me very much. If it comes from Sanskrit, as I've heard, it signifies making. Now, everyone makes something, and those who make things on a canvas with a frame, they're called artists. Formerly, they were called craftsmen, a term might be heard. We're all craftsmen in civilian or military, or artistic life. The distinction that needs to be drawn, Duchamp suggests, is that between art and craft. The techniques many people can be trained to master without making anything that you can. In a mass society like ours, where those who make things on a canvas with a frame are classified as artists, the observer must approach the art in a certain way. The artists who exhibit
although it's like had been physically smaller to put the glass, like the stack of glass Tupperwares together and put the lids separately, I think that separating the lids from the thing,
the skill of these paintings is evident. No doubt the majority of the writers.
So I'm going to leave them all together.
I was actually surprised looking through them how skillful they are. Occasionally, one of these paintings turns up in the auction catalog, but the large majority
one agrees with you. Yes.
Any of the names
JC.
Is such painting all that different from the large anonymous craft we associate with needlepoint, jewelry, pottery? I tried to Chantal's cabaret.
Well, that's a nice little Tupperware shelf, you too.
Not to call what had happened before. I've had an obsession about not using the same things. Thus, in his delay in glass, the bride stood bare. By her bachelor's even, Duchamp works to rehabilitate point perspective, to mix story, anecdote, in a good sense of word.
Yeah, you've got your own stock collection anyway, right? Yeah.
While giving less importance to the visual element than
you're not playing that game.
The aim was to produce works that could not be looked at in the aesthetic sense of the word. And he explains, since Courbet, it's been believed that painting is used to
the granola industry. That's nothing for me.
Before, painting had other functions. It could be religious, philosophical, our whole century is completely revenue, except for the surrealists who tried to go outside it somehow. And still, they didn't go so far. Down deep on the top is still really interested in painting.
About these noodles?
It's absolutely ridiculous. It must change. This was the understanding of early avant-garde practice. Duchamp did not reject art. What he rejected was what he labeled revenue art specifically. The realist and impressionist painting of the 19th century, as he had witnessed it, especially in Paris of his youth, the art of sensuous service and visual pleasure designed to ensure art. For the 20th century, Duchamp said something different was something more intellectual that might engage in the culture with its advertising. The U.S. entry into the Great War made such invention more urgent. By August 1918, Duchamp was in Buenos Aires, where he tried to escape the war, only to learn soon after arrival that his beloved brother Raymond had been killed in action. Given these circumstances, Heinrich Kellbaum's sentimental and idealized image of American immigrant life must have struck Duchamp as somewhat absurd and irrelevant. The making of an American, perhaps the presentation of the shovel itself, literally captured in advance of the working arm, was more consequent than the conditions of modern life. And by the way, he was so devoted to his brother, Chuck didn't speak to anybody for months when he went back to his home. He was very attached to him, and that was a terrible thing for him. It really was. So he was paying a lot of attention to the day-to-day events of his life. Perhaps the clearest statement Duchamp made about the meaning of the real thing is found in a little-known interview. A little-known interview with the art historian George Bernard Hamilton, recorded in 1959 as part of a BBC series. And Hamilton says, "Is there any way in which we can think of a ready man as a work of art? Duchamp. That is a very difficult point because art first has to be defined. We have tried, everyone has tried, in every century there's a new definition of art. I mean that there is no one essential that is good for all centuries. So if we accept the idea that trying not to define art is a legitimate conception, then the ready-made can be seen as a sort of irony or an attempt of showing the futility of trying to define art. Because here it is, a thing that I call art. I didn't make it myself, and as we know, art means to make, handmade, to make my own. It's a handmade product of man. There, instead of making, I take it ready, even though it's not. But it's not fake art.
Those have a return.
Sorry?
You get money for
those. You don't define electricity. You see electricity as a result of your hand. You can't say what it is, but you know what it does. You see that it's the same thing with art. You know what art does, but you know what it is. It's a sort of inner current in man or something that you don't have to define. With the ready-mades, it seems to me that they carry out the world of everyday life. Out of the hardware shop, as in the case of the snow shop, something of your own sense of irony and wit, and therefore can we believe that they have some sort of message. Not message, but value, which is artistic even though you haven't made it. The actual intention of choosing and selecting and setting it aside from everything else in the world, does that not give some kind of possibly intellectual value? It has a conceptual value, if you want, but it takes away all technical jargon. Not message, but value, not setting the object in question apart from everything else in the world. The visual indifference is not for Duchamp equivalent to aesthetic difference. On the contrary, art is an inner current, and defined not by what it is, but what it does. And here's the foundation of much that is to come through the conceptual art. In Duchamp's case, conceptualism can hand in hand with intertextuality. Specifically, the ironic dialogue of the work of against the
expressionism,
and even abstract forms created by the artist.
It's a hard system to install.
This is Mrs. A. Roosevelt.
It takes a lot of
abstract tennis ball.
Years.
Featured on the first page of the 1917 exhibition. The ready-made was very important in the setting of introducing humor in a very serious way. And so we thought Fountain by Art Mutt. Now, far from being an ordinary object, it was a conceptual production. The upside-down urinal with its
comes from the
center. I don't know, dude. What's up?
Richard Mutt, rich man with a special androgynous. A work not made but chosen and assisted with the title of Dick. Photographed by Stieglitz, it emerges as
the
And thus it is depicted in Blind Man, the magazine for those who don't see. So just think, can one
downstairs.
The original question, make
what? Drain downstairs. Downstairs. Although that's a lot of oil.
The Fountain refused admission to his art galleries containing 2,000 items. Has become the object of celebrating as one of
the kind of thing, it's like, if there's a fruit fly.
Listen to so many critics of art that triumph in demonic music or high art. Did Duchamp's ostensible repudiation of the aesthetic help to break down the person? The great divide. The J.L. Mott urinal was certainly low in Northern Ireland. I as was the shovel.
Something like that. Put that whole thing full of food in the rest
the role of art from the Jaws perspective is not to reach out to such things,
I don't know, dude.
Which will often see they in the art world, and grant them equal time in the interest of equal representation.
It's weird.
This is now commonly thought but to transform. The actual intention in choosing and selecting and setting aside the chosen object from the hardware store, from everything else in the world, was nothing if not aesthetic. The paradox being that the aesthetic no longer could once suggest and once again suggest that other part of the sublime. It's one of the delicious ironies of art history. Indeed, the carefully calculated trick to Champlain and his fellow organizers of the 1917 Salon raises larger issues about the relationship of aesthetic choice to its particular frontier. The making of an art work, let's remember, is never a direct response to this or that cultural constraint. It's always a
reason
occupying as a
culture
a space containing multiple rivals and allies, as well as the star. Accordingly, to begin with theory, the theory of postmodernism, while art under late capitalism has been standard practice for decades now, artworks and poems being regarded as so many examples of this or that theory can be quite misleading, and we do see so much of this. If somebody quotes a theory, then they find the artwork that fits the theory. Talk about it. Now consider the so-called novelty poetry war. Consider the so-called poetry wars that began with Donald Allen's Women in 1960 and have continued into the present, fueled by an uncontested discourse that separates experimental from mainstream, post-avant from school of quietude and what someone is vocabulary. The division began, so the textbook version would have it, with the post-World War II division between Philip Roth had rather inappropriately dubbed pale face and red skin, the raw and the cooked, with the Beats and Black Mountain poets on one side and the Randall Jarrell, Robert Lowell, genteel tradition on the other. Both sides, in fact, advocated a revitalized romanticism, contra the impersonal theory of T.S. Eliot, as codified by the new clinical poets of the 40s. Like Ginsberg and Creeley, Lowell and Berryman were keen admirers of William Carlos Williams and the then neglected Mark Twain. More important, even as this family feud was raging, the real action, aesthetically speaking, may well have been elsewhere. The artistic diaspora of the post-war brought Dada and surrealism, electricism and Brazilian concrete, the poetics of negritude, and the theories of the Frankfurt School to the U.S. The interaction of these foreign elements with native streams that had largely been latent or underground produced what is, to my mind, the real avant-garde of the 1960s, which was quickly absorbed into the larger culture of drugs and Zen, and not the didacticism. If you would disagree with me, of course, as projected course, but the markedly different and difficult aesthetic of John Cage, the practically Yankee version of the West, shared by a brilliant set of artists and different behaviors, Cunningham, Jasper Johns, Fluxus artists, Chip Pope, Jackson Poe, as well as those early Cage works. Like Duchamp's rejection of the creative function of the artist, O'Hara's famed was a carefully planned gesture, a way of separating himself from the grand pronunciamentos he associated, rightly or wrongly, which such Lowell dicta as a savage slugs. The reception of language poetry has had a similar trajectory. For years, students of the movement have accepted its own formulations at face value. The dissolution of a coherent lyric self, the negation of the referential function of language, the construction of the text meaning by the reader rather than the author, the insistence that direct communication was the hallmark of the commodity fetish and hence unacceptable, and above all, the symbiotic relationship between poetry and theory, which has oddly enough given us a fair amount of what we might call poetics without poetry. There's no poetry, it's just poetics. These have long been accepted as axiomatic features of the new poetics. But from the vantage point of the 21st century, the attack on the authoritative I can now be understood as a way of unmasking the reliance on the unique voice in the dominant workshop poetry of the 70s and 80s. When, in other words, Charles Bernstein began his 1976 Stray Straws and Straw Men with the parodic declaration, I look straight into my heart and write the exact words that come from within, he surely had in mind not the profound lyric of Blake, or Hölderlin, or Baudelaire, the self-consciousness of Baudelaire, but the timid revelations of suburban married life that were then filling the pages of American Poetry Review. To understand what Bernstein has called in the title essay of his most recent book, The Attack of the Difficult Poems, you might for a moment, I'll get killed for saying this, but I'll say it anyway, you might for a moment put aside your Adorno or Agamben and pick up Gerald Stern's Lucky Life, Carnegie Mellon, Philip Levine's The Names of the Lost, Athenaeum, or Lewis Simpson's Searching for the Ox, Oxford. I love it that it's called Searching for the Ox. All three published like Stray Straws in our bicentennial year, 1976. The recent advocacy of conceptualism on the part of, say, Craig Dworkin or Vanessa Place is similarly site-specific. It is directed not against Pound's Cantos or Joyce's Finnegan's Wake, themselves in large part composed of other people's words, but against an abstraction and opacity valorized perhaps by second-generation language poets that sometimes seem to deny the very possibility that anyone might actually read a given text. Perhaps this reasoning goes, it is possible to make sense, even as one calls into question sense-making, as did George Perec in La Vie Maud d'Emploi, an intricate and tricky Oulipo novel that is nonetheless highly readable and accessible to a wider audience. The referential fallacy, as it was called by Steve McCaffrey, Bruce Andrews is no longer the enemy, rather the originality associated with what was still a pre-digital, pre-internet moment in poetry is what is now being questioned, and that'll change again too. From Eliot's definition of poetry as an escape from emotion to Lynne Ginian's rejection of closure and Kenneth Goldsmith's case for uncreative writing, oppositionality has thus meant opposition not to the aesthetic itself, but to the status quo. Goldsmith's uncreative writing, far from being based on the conversations overheard in the New York streets, derives its formal structures from Andy Warhol and John Cage, from David Anton's talk pieces, and Steve McCaffrey's early permutative poems like Carnival. As in the case of all poetry, it has to be read closely and carefully to be understood, whatever the poet's tongue-in-cheek claim for its essential unreadability and boredom. Direct treatment of the thing, declared Ezra Pound, in what was to become one of the most famous of 20th century manifestos, only to produce in the Cantos a network of citations and foreign phrases that often contain not a single sensuous or concrete image. Not so much direct treatment. Never trust the artist, trust the tale, said D.H. Lawrence. Let me conclude with a reconsideration of the aesthetics of everyday, the ordinary, the breakdown of the distinction between art and life that Peter Berger and so many others have taken as the hallmark of Duchamp Dada and its neo-Dada manifestations today. How ordinary is the ordinary? And how does the artist convey life itself? Even street art, after all, is founded on codes and norms learned from its forerunners. And the seemingly simplest of ready-mades, like Duchamp's dog poem, come to us framed and unfinished. The most satisfying theory of everyday practice, and I know, may well be that of the ordinary language philosopher who is Duchamp's exact contemporary, Wittgenstein, you know. A contemporary who ironically knew nothing about the inventor of Armand and Oro Syllabi and would have hated them, would have scoffed at these foolish ready-mades had he so much as heard of them. I mean, Wittgenstein wouldn't even listen to Mahler, that's much too modern, didn't like that, you know. But, so he would have scoffed at it, but just the same, he understood it. Indeed, like Duchamp, Wittgenstein is generally considered an enemy of aesthetics. You might think, he declared famously, aesthetics is a science telling us what's beautiful. Too ridiculous for words. I suppose it ought to also include what sort of coffee tastes good. Or again, in Wittgenstein's Cambridge lectures for 1932, we read, the words beautiful and ugly are bound up with the words they modify, and when applied to a face are not the same as when applied to flowers and trees. For Wittgenstein, aesthetics is always and only descriptive. What it does is to draw one's attention to certain features, to place things side by side so as to exhibit those features. Now here, as in Duchamp, is the context theory, of aesthetic value. In a 1930 notebook begun shortly after Wittgenstein had returned to Cambridge to take up his career as a philosopher, we read, "Nothing could be more remarkable than seeing someone engaged in some simple everyday activity when he thinks he's not being watched. Let's imagine a theater. The curtain goes up, and we see someone alone in his room walking up and down, lighting a cigarette, sitting down, etc., so that we're suddenly seeing someone from the outside in a way that we can never see ourselves, as if we, so to speak, witnessed a chapter of our biography with our own eyes. That would be disturbing and wonderful at the same time. More wonderful than anything that a dramatist could produce to be performed or spoken on stage. We would be seeing life itself, but then we do see this every day, and it doesn't make the slightest impression on us. Yes, but we don't see it in perspective. The work of art forces us, so to speak, to see it in the right perspective. But without art, the object is only a part of nature like any other, and the fact that we can exalt it without enthusiasm gives no one the right to thrust it upon us. It always reminds me of one of those insipid snapshots that the person who took it finds interesting because he was there himself, because he experienced it, but which a third party experiences with justifiable coldness, insofar as it is ever justifiable to look at something coldly. Now note that unlike the major theorists of modernism, from Mallarmé and Eliot or, say, Roman Jakobson, Wittgenstein is not saying that there's a special language for poetry. He was one of the few people who never believed that, distinct from ordinary language. On the contrary, as he puts it in the famous aphorism, in Settle, do not forget that although poetry is written in the language of information, it is not used in the language game of giving information. Now, what transformed the former is not metaphor or rhetorical figure or elaborate sound structuring, at least in the example he gives. The language itself remains that of information. That's really a hard thing to understand. It hasn't changed the language. The language remains that of information. What transforms it is context and function, framing. Now, just as the snow shovel becomes other by its being hung from the ceiling and labeled in advance of the broken arm, so the most ordinary of actions, a man crossing a street and lighting a cigarette, are transformed by seeing them in perspective. The life before us, whether in a poem or snapshot, recycled and framed, becomes more wonderful than anything a dramatist could produce to be performed or spoken on stage. And so central is choice for Wittgenstein that the right aesthetic decision for him is also ethical. In his words, the aesthetic and the ethical are one, which is, I think, what Craig Dworkin meant when he writes in the preface to his anthology of conceptual writing, the question remains not whether one of these works could have been done better, but whether it could have possibly been done differently at all. And that question brings us back to Duchamp's urgent question, can one make works that are not works of art? Too often this is read as if it were equivalent, say, to Joseph Bouy's later claim that everyone is an artist. I have a figure for that. Whoops. Did it go down? I just wanted you to see the... What happened? It is? I don't see anything. Oh, yeah, they're Joseph Beuys. There's the Joseph Beuys poster. Duchamp never made this case, and I think that's very important to keep those two things separate. Beuys said everyone can be an artist. In our modern age, everyone can be an artist. That's very different from saying, can one make works that are not works of art? Duchamp never made this case. On the contrary, his view was that art was so important it couldn't be left to those who are called artists. If he made this point obliquely, it was no doubt because he felt that in a demotic age, the age of ordinary experience, irony was more effective than assertiveness, humor more effective than the language of perpetual crisis. Then, too, nothing remains the same. Who knows in 2011 what the new poetics of 2020 will look like? I certainly don't. I have no idea. And it will certainly be different again. Some things remain the same, but a lot else changes. Questioned by Pierre Caban about the motive of the large glass, Duchamp remarked that perspective was very important. The large glass constitutes a rehabilitation of perspective, which had then been completely ignored and disparaged. For me, perspective became absolutely scientific, mathematical scientific perspective based on calculations and dimensions. Here Duchamp was surely, aside from other things, taking a little poke at Apollinaire, his friend, who as spokesman for the new spirit in the France of the World War I years, had dismissed perspective as totally passé. And that was the word, of course, from Picasso, too. That was the word, no more perspective. Certainly the Cubists had made this case. When a particular aesthetic notion becomes a piety, Duchamp implies, it's time, in Cage's words, to do something else. Indeed, perhaps it is time to remember that the pleasure we take in the productions of art, now as in the past, is the pleasure of what Duchamp, recapturing the 1911 performance of Raymond Roussel's L'Impression d'Afrique, called the madness of the unexpected. Thank you.
Wow.
Yeah.
That was a really warm and pleasing show today. Very stimulating. I had a great time. How about you, Steve?
Oh, yeah. I had maybe one of the best times.
Yeah. No, you're absolutely correct. I say we give Miss Perlov a round of applause.
Here, here.
Well, that's all we have for you today, everyone. Please tune in next week to the Talking Show on KTN Radio. Bye for now.
See you then.
Put the cinnamon. Yeah.